Good afternoon. The announcements did mention that the Black Horse series and the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse series, part two, overall, I guess part seven in the series, was completed. And I did something yesterday I have not done and never been able to do. I suppose I wish I could, and the Media Production Service Department would probably agree. I finished four more broadcasts, actually five more, but I did four more this week, and I'm now officially, I guess, 5 weeks ahead. I finished yesterday the second part of A Fourth of Men, much of what the sermon last week was about. And I'm actually going to read a little bit more here in a moment from the book, portions that you've not seen, my new book. But I finished Black Horse Part 3, The Pale Horse Part 1 and 2, and A Fourth of Men Part 1 and 2. So I'm actually five broadcasts ahead, which means I think that fifth one will be posted on November 26th. I'm that far ahead, 5 weeks from yesterday. And I'm sure that'll never happen again. But I wanted to be as far ahead as possible, partly because we're going to have to renovate the studio for 10 days. I wasn't sure whether I would be able to use it with proper fireproofing. But I also got one audio prepared yesterday. So sometime this week, possibly Monday, probably later in the week, I will begin daily audios. And we're doing well in that regard. It's kind of interesting. We had an inquiry this week from an advertising agency. I want to give you a little bit of general news before getting into so very much to cover. A company, a small ad company that handles some really big clients, and they represent Roslyn Capital. Probably if you watch Fox News, they advertise all the time. They contacted us and want to explore going on the Fox News channel, but it's kind of interesting. They contacted one of the groups, well, one of the splinters, I should say, I think one of the big ones. I never even answered them. And the fellow, I guess, goes back to Mr. Armstrong's time and has a particular interest who works for this agency. If I'm not mistaken, it's in Michigan. We'll see how things go. I know they have a particular interest, more than I have time to really tell you here. Also, Mr. Bear got back from New York City. He flew over this week and met with a variety of people. Maybe the next time he speaks, if it's next week, he can give you a little more about his trip. Very profitable in a host of ways. And I can tell you this much. We have some pretty strong leads, one in particular of a publisher who will pick up my new book. And we may find that it is advantageous or necessary to have one company handle it electronically in terms of marketing e-books, and another company, actually another publishing house, do the hard copies, softbound or hardbound. So we'll see how that develops, and I'm encouraged. We'll know more perhaps even as soon as this week. We're not near the contract stage by any means, but we'll see how it develops. Again, the statistics in the work are exploding about just about every way. I think I was looking at a report yesterday. I think the entire church grew something like 2% worldwide in the last 10 days. Of course, that's the most important and most interesting statistic. I don't know if that's ever happened or would ever happen again, but that's certainly encouraging to see. Now, as I said, I have an awful lot to cover, and it's going to take all of the rest of this service and probably a little bit over time, not as much as last week, and then a full long Bible study after we enjoy a delicious meal. And I'm going to have to move very fast to be able to accomplish that. But whatever it takes, I want to just tell you now, that's how long we're going. If we're done sooner, fine. I doubt it. We'll see. All right, I opened last week with something that I intended to open again with this week, and it was a brief reference to a section of the Cleveland Plain Dealer. Many papers have a similar inside page two of the front section. There is a small kind of area or section that covers what the Plain Dealer calls Earth Week. And it spots around the world and tells you, as it says at the top, seven things you should know about the planet. And when you see how things are growing worse, I've been reading these for years now, you would agree, you should know them. Most people don't know them and don't even care to know them, and if you try to tell them, they're not interested. But many do want to know, and of course all of God's people had better want to know. But here's an example of some things that were included this week. You'll recall last week. Here are the seven things they give you. Number one, cattle plague may be declared eradicated soon. Maybe. And they report, this is unique because it's the first time in history, if it happens, that man has ever eliminated a single animal disease. I think that's more interesting, not for the fact that it might be progress. That's wonderful. I hope they do eliminate the disease. It's a viral disease, but what's more interesting is man has been battling disease for 6,000 years, and as of this morning, ironically, the first time I've ever read anything like this where there was a thought that maybe we've just defeated our very first animal disease. And about two-thirds of all diseases that strike human beings start with animals. I don't know if this was one that had that capability. It doesn't directly affect people now, but it's caused outbreaks of famine all over the world, this disease. So, you know, men might be rejoicing today. Right below it is a statement about how 2010 is going to be the hottest year on record. It's currently tied with 1998, but probably will be hotter as a result of the fact that the trends for the rest of the year look pretty warm. 98, I guess, was not, so it may be the hottest year ever. And people, of course, want to argue whether there's global warming. It isn't relevant. You know, global warming has been dropped as a term because it's more politically correct to say climate change. I normally don't agree. I don't know if I've ever agreed with political correctness. God's church is not politically correct. We're about as politically incorrect as you could possibly be. But that may be one term I agree with. There is climate change going on. Prophecy would tell you that. So it doesn't make any difference whether it would be global warming as the radical left might declare it. It is getting hotter for reasons we could probably understand just knowing what the four horsemen represent. Now, most of what I'm going to talk about today is not the four horsemen, but I want to get you back into where we were. In theory, last week's nearly two-hour sermon, maybe the longest single sermon I've ever given, and then three more today, is really one sermon, but you can't give it all in one Sabbath. Below on number three is global warming. Now, here they actually use the word, expected to spawn widespread drought. And it says, a second report in as many weeks. Remember I read one last week in the Earth Week? Points to a much drier planet emerging as a result of climate change. Researchers from the U.S. National Center for Atmospheric Research conclude that the warming global climate will likely create unprecedented dry conditions across much of the globe for at least the next 30 years. Well, we know that time isn't going to go on more than a fraction of 30 years. That'll be the least of what mankind is worrying about. And then it also says, and one of the other problems is some of the areas that are not drier will be much wetter. And so, you know, prophecy shows that both a drying and mildew, which God talks about, will worsen and both destroy crops. For instance, if Russia suffered a tremendous drought, the worst in 131 years of record keeping this summer, Canada suffered tremendous rain and lost a third of its crop. It doesn't make any difference what could cause it, or Australia, they're now facing an unprecedented locust plague. You can lose it that way. You can lose it three different ways. Or you can even see famine, of course, because something strikes cattle. Number four, fiery blast from volcano sends residents running in Colombia. Number five, earthquakes felt around the world. Starting with New Zealand, and it talks about one there, and then a 6.9, I believe, just south of San Diego, Baja California area. 50,000 homes, I guess, were destroyed by this one. And then there was also another one in Taiwan, central Chile, and northwestern Mexico. And then number six, super typhoon slams into Philippines. And it talks about the death toll, the worst storm to hit the region in nearly 20 years. Created waves as high as houses, wind gusts 160 miles per hour, and basically, I guess it's largely over. I don't know if they know the damage, but it hit one of the largest agricultural areas in northern Luzon for the Philippines. I've been to that area. And then number seven, I mean, just think about how prophetic these are in terms of what you've read in the book recently and also what we talked about last week and what is so plainly covered in God's Word. Here's number seven. Monkeys go wild and invade village. Now, these are still largely anecdotal stories, but 60 monkeys, for some strange reason, just flipped and charged into a village and destroyed it. It was in Indonesia. And then there is this conclusion, animal-human conflicts are increasing around the world. And, of course, God is going to strike more than the descendants of the 12 tribes of Israel with animals and animal attacks. Deforestation and loss of habitat have increasingly caused conflict between human residents and wildlife on Sumatra. Many parts of the island are once again blanketed in a thick pall of smoke. They do this every year. From seasonal agricultural burning, as well as forest clearing to establish new plantations. And there are a host of other problems having to do with pollution and lack of oxygen on the earth, a lot of other problems that flow from the burning. But when you burn areas that the monkeys had, maybe God has built it into the ecology in a certain way that they get angry. Now, if you think about all the things that we've covered regarding the four horsemen, let me just make, for the first of probably two or three times I'll say this, it is during this horrible period where these kinds of anecdotes become pervasive in the news, widespread, that the work, God's final work, must be finished. I want to take you now back to the three Gospels, and we're going to pick up in the same three Olivet prophecies and see what Christ said. And we're going to look at certain promises of God. Remember last week I mentioned we're going to look at certain promises of God, very basic in the Scriptures, that the final generation on earth and even in among God's people cannot claim. They are literally unclaimable, immutable promises of God. Now, what in the world does that mean? Well, stay with me. Remember, part one, we went through all of the different conditions, war, famine, disease, of course, false Christianity, as well as earthquakes, volcanoes, troubles in the book of Mark, and explained how in Luke, Christ didn't say earthquakes, he said great earthquakes. The Greek was megas, in other words, meaning mega earthquakes, greater than ever in history and more frequent. Now, I want to go back just for a moment in Matthew, and I want to throw an interesting thought at you. Think of what I'm saying now as not the beginning of this sermon, but 2 hours in, or a little more than 2 hours into the sermon. I want to offer you a fascinating thought. Remember, we talked about what the word end means when it appears five times in Matthew 24. How, for instance, the first four times it's one Greek word, telos, which means the goal. When Christ talked about the end four times to the disciples, he didn't mean just when everything concludes. He had in mind, and this will be clearer as we go on, the goal, or the point aimed at as a limit, to set out for a definite point or goal. That's what the word end means when you read it four times in verses 3, 6, 13, and 14. And that it's a different word in verse 31. And there, remember, was the Greek word, ironically enough, akron. Akron. And that means summit, tip, or top, where it talks about end there. And there are other Greek words translated end in other places. And until you go into the Greek, you can't really appreciate that God has this tremendous goal that his people in the final generation have to reach. Now, here's the point. Here's what's fascinating. I'd like to offer you a thought. The very first thing that Christ uttered when his disciples asked him privately, "What shall be the sign of your coming and of the end of the world?" Verse 3, the end of verse 3. The first thing Christ warned about, and we know this was not to them, it's to us. So the first thing Christ said to the 21st century generation that would precede his return was this. Now think about it from a different perspective. Take heed that no man deceive you. Now, it couldn't mean the disciples then. It means the disciples now. For many shall come in my name, saying, I am Christ, and shall deceive many. Now, we know from Revelation 6 that Christ interpreted, and you could say this either way, Christ interpreted in Revelation 6, the first 8 verses, what he says here about war, famine, disease, false religion, earthquakes, and so forth prior to his return. Or you could say in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, he interprets Revelation. You could say it either way. But when you put it all together, and you realize that everything has to happen in one generation. Remember, we talked about that last week. Matthew, Mark, and Luke, it's going to happen in one generation. And the book of Revelation warns, John recorded, don't add to this book or subtract from the book, or the plagues in it, Revelation, will be added to you, or if you subtract from the book, you make the book of Revelation say or mean anything other than exactly what God intended. God says, then you'll be, if you take words away, your name will be taken out of the book of life or out of the kingdom of God. In other words, that's another way of saying it is an immutable word. Matthew, Mark, and Luke, it's heaven and earth shall pass. In other words, the continued existence of the universe is tied to the certainty of these prophecies. Remember, we covered that last week. It will all happen in one generation. This generation shall not pass. Heaven and earth shall pass before all these things be fulfilled in one generation. Stated almost identically in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. Now, start with the common perception of a generation as 30 years. Now, I want you to go back in your mind 3 years, almost exactly 3 years to the week when I gave a sermon explaining what the 1,335 days was before Christ returns, mentioned only in Daniel 12. I think we titled the sermon the 1,335. It was the part one of the Clarion Call sermon. And we did some math on how long the 6,000 years would be in God's 7,000-year plan, 6,000 before Christ returns. And if creation was in 3981 B.C., we did some math. You come to around right around 2020, no year zero. You do the math. Well, you back up 3.5 years, and we know that the work is cut short. You get down to maybe about the latest the work could go is 2016. Early 2016. And here's an interesting thing to consider. Recognizing that Christ is warning the final generation about deception that threatens us, what kind of math comes to mind? I mean, before I explain a little bit more, and you may be putting a couple things together, what the Catholic Church does doesn't threaten our understanding. What Buddhists do, what Taoists, Shintoists, Muslims do, doesn't threaten our understanding. We're very unlikely to be deceived by those. The white horse, often thought of as false religion, which it is, false Christianity rather, is described by Christ here as a threat to us. Take heed that no man deceive you. Hundreds of millions of people are deceived by false Christianity. And all of the thousands of forms of false Christianity are not much of a threat to us until the death of Mr. Armstrong, almost 25 years ago. Almost immediately, and I would say immediately, and I'm going to tell you something that you might find interesting if I've never told you before, a totally alien mind entered the church. In less than 3 months, it will be 25 years since Mr. Armstrong died. Mr. Armstrong died at 6 in the morning. I want to be dramatic here for a moment. His successor, by noon of the first day that he died, January 16th, 1986, by noon had violated a host of absolute promises he made Mr. Armstrong before he died. Began casting the people who were close to Mr. Armstrong out of the way and already was pursuing an agenda to change certain things. Literally, I mean, people very close to Mr. Armstrong were sacked within 6 hours of his death. When do you think deception began? I could tell you many stories, and then this would be a 10-hour sermon. But suffice to say, beginning almost 25 years ago, and I could even make a case because of things I had to personally endure at the hand of that very same man, that it started before that. Now, people always want to say, for instance, if I could shift, that the Laodicean church, a lot of people want to say, oh, the Laodicean church began on January 16, 1986. Poppycock. You can't say that. The Laodicean church began whenever the predominant number of people who had God's Spirit in his church were lukewarm and had lost zeal. That's when it began. As soon as the dominant number were now lukewarm, that's when the Laodicean age began. To assign that to the day he died is ridiculous. And there's a whole theology about why people do that. We don't have time to get into all of that. But take 30 years from the immediate deception that began at Mr. Armstrong's death, and you come to, on the outside, early 2016. This generation shall not pass. The most common definition of a generation is 30 years. Now, I don't make that some kind of immutable proof. There are many, many, many things that make us believe that we have roughly that many years left. Now, that said, Christ would not have given all of these prophecies that we talked about last week and then not told his servants what you had better be doing in your own private lives. Now, in each of the three accounts, he follows the description of the horsemen and earthquakes and finishing the work with a description of the fifth, sixth, and seventh seals of Revelation 6 and after. Fifth seal, great tribulation. Sixth seal, the awful, awful heavenly signs, and the seventh seal, the wrath of God, or the day of the Lord, mentioned all through the Old Testament. And of course, when the end comes for those who've been faithful, and they're willing to do the work, when the first four seals are open, the first four, you know, the horses and horsemen are riding, and things grow worse and worse and worse, the promise for them is they avoid the truly horrific fifth, sixth, and seventh seals. But only if they're doing certain things. So in each case, he talks about the timeline. He's answering the question, what's the sign of your coming of the end of the world? So Christ didn't stop in verse 14, for instance, of Matthew 24. He didn't stop there at the end of the work. He continued to talk about, now here you flee. Those who are in Judea, flee to the mountains. God's people will have gathered in Judea. And you flee to the mountains and you're protected, and then comes great tribulation, and then the heavenly signs are described. And again, you come down to verse 23. Then if any man shall say unto you, lo, here is Christ, or there, believe it not. More and more are going to say that Christ has arrived. The story's just a legion. For there shall arise false Christs and false prophets and show great signs and wonders in an attempt to deceive the very elect. Some of these things are going to affect God's people in the splinters in the seventh era. Behold, I've told you before, verse 25. Christ had warned about deception many times. I don't know how many times he talked about war, famine, disease, and earthquakes, but you know he'd warned about deception before, and he mentions it three times in Matthew 24 and says, I've talked about it before, verse 25. Wherefore, if they shall say unto you, behold, he's in the desert, don't go there, the secret chambers, believe it not. You know, the Jehovah Witnesses buy into all that nonsense. And then it talks about how Christ would return. And you come down to verse 32. So that's where we're going to pick up for a moment. Verse 32. Now learn a parable of the fig tree. When his branch is yet tender and puts forth leaves, you know that summer is near. So likewise, you, when you shall see all these things, know that it is near, even at the doors. Now, Christ is talking again to the final generation. If you're carefully observing and watching, you will understand. Nobody else will. Remember, the book of Revelation, it says in the first three verses, was written to God's people. That's why whenever you see people out in the world trying to explain the book of Revelation, they tangle it all up. They make it into a Gordian knot. They miss things that are impossible to misunderstand, because it wasn't given to them. It's for God's servants to keep and obey. So we're going to see and watch and understand things that others won't see. Can't see. Not that most of them, or very many of them, are even trying or interested. Now think about that. Likewise, let me read again, verse 33. So likewise you, when you shall see all these things, know that it is near, even at the doors. You're supposed to be able to know. One of the problems that God's people have is they're afraid to know or afraid to think they can know absolutely with certainty things Christ said you can know. He said, by their fruits you know them. Oh, no, no, you'd be judging people if you look at their fruits. No, Christ said you can know them, and you shall know them by their fruits in Matthew 7. I'm not afraid to know people by their fruits because Christ said I can. I don't have to condemn them to the lake of fire. I can know, you can know that summer is very near if you're doing certain things. Now, let's keep reading. Verily I say unto you, this generation shall not pass till all these things be fulfilled. How certain is it? Heaven and earth shall pass away, but my word shall not pass away. Ask yourself if Christ believed his own words. He was the one who actually created the heavens and the earth, not the Father. So here's the same God who created the heavens and the earth and is uttering these words. Christ was the God of the Old Testament. Of course, most don't understand that. And so he's attaching the very creation he brought to the continuance of these words, the certainty of those words. But of that day and hour knows no man, no, not the angels of heaven, but my Father only. Then it compares it to Noah's time. And I've explained, verse 38, for in the days that before the flood they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage until the day that Noah entered into the ark. Now we're going to see 2 billion people will probably die in the next handful of years. 2 billion. I know that nobody else is saying that because they don't understand it. But yet it happens in a way where everybody thinks life's normal. Giving and taking in marriage, you know, eating, drinking, still going out, partying. And I'll come in a minute. I want to reiterate why people cannot see it happening. I can easily prove to you that 100 million people are dying of these things every year right now. I'll prove it to you. That would be the most lowball estimate right now, and it's accelerating. All right, now, verse 42. Here comes some instruction. Watch you therefore, for you know not what hour your Lord does come. Now there's the word watch. But know this, that if the good man of the house had known in what watch, there it is the second time, the thief would come, he would have watched. There's the third time. And would not have suffered his house to be broken up. What person who's planning to go shopping, if he got an email from a crook, a burglar, says, I'm going to be hitting your house while you're at the mall, wouldn't change his plans and stay home. So if you're watching all the time and you've arranged a way to kind of watch and cover yourself, maybe you have a camera at home. I don't know, a security system. I'm trying, you know, every analogy breaks down at a point, but I'm trying to illustrate the meaning here. Therefore, be you also ready. Your spiritual condition is ready. For in such an hour as you think not, the Son of Man comes. Now I want to ask you to believe that. You can know summer's near. But still, at the very end, it's going to fool us. It'll be a time you think not. Even God's people are told, you're going to think it's at this point, and it will be at some other point. So the only way to be protected is to be watching all the time. Now, we either believe Christ or we don't. Who then is a faithful and wise servant, whom his Lord has made ruler over his household, to give them meat in due season? That could be talking in a way to me, a warning to me, but to every one of us individually. I choose to take it to me personally because I'm one of the members of the church too, so it at least applies to me in that way. But every one of you are stewards over a household, if you will. The last part of the verse I take is a certain interesting meaning. But it's also talking, of course, to all of God's people. So let's continue. Blessed is that servant. Which servant? Any servant, all of God's servants, whom his Lord, when he comes, shall find so doing. Now, what was the setup earlier in the chapter? Finishing the work of God, announcing the coming world-ruling supergovernment, coming to all nations, number one, and warning the greatest nations, the descendants of Israel, of extreme punishment just over the horizon, but also growing personally. Let's read. Verily I say unto you that he shall make him ruler over all his goods. That's the instruction to you, the encouragement. But and if that evil servant shall say in his heart, my Lord delays his coming, he lets up, backs off, quiets down, cools down, then and begin to smite his fellow servants and to eat and drink with the drunken. If you look at what's going on in the splinters, it's tragic. Another evangelist was fired a week ago today. I know this fellow very, very well. Had a lot of run-ins with him. But the Lord of that servant shall come in a day when he looks not for him, and in an hour that he is not aware of, and shall cut him asunder and appoint him his portion with the hypocrites. Why hypocrites, where there's weeping and gnashing of teeth? Well, if we were all taught by Mr. Armstrong, beginning in my case almost 45 years ago, that the sole purpose I was called now was to finish the all-important single, one generation, as it were, work of God, and then I live my life in a totally different way, other than centered and focused on that, as well as, of course, developing the character of God, holy, righteous, perfect character, and I'm living a totally different way, a double life, that's called hypocrisy. A lot of people pretend they're doing the work today, may not be included among us. All right, now, again, Matthew, unlike Mark and Luke, goes on for another entire chapter, and obviously chapter 25 has to be talking at the end of the age. Mark and Luke do not go on and say these things, but you have the parable of the virgins in chapter 25. Then shall the kingdom of heaven be like unto a virgin. When? Then. Then, at that time, at the end. Still answering the verse 3 question of 24. Which took their lamps, went forth to meet the bridegroom. And five of them were wise, five were foolish. And, of course, this is at the time of Christ's return. And I don't have time to read all the way through it. You know it well. But anyway, some, verse 8, give us of your oil, for our lamps are going out. The lamp in the Bible, Psalms, makes it very clear, the Psalms, that's God's word. And oil is a type of God's spirit. A lot of people have let God's spirit in them dwindle. As a result, they read the Bible and they lose sight of truths. I've seen it happen to tens of thousands of people. I pastored almost 11,000 people in my ministry. I wonder, where are all of them? I taught them all the exact, the same things, the same truth. Where are they? Were they listening? And the answer is probably most of them didn't. Some of them were listening, but had never proven when they were first called. Prove all things, hold fast that which is good. I did. I had to. I had a lot to give up. I was a kid growing up 3 hours west of here. I'm very thankful. I had quite a successful sports career. Maybe I wouldn't have proven in the same way. I had a lot at stake. Successful family. And all of a sudden, wham, I got hit over the head with a crowbar by God and realized that, well, a Presbyterian church isn't the right place to be. I was the fastest swimmer in the world. You think I didn't start taking a serious look at, wait a minute, I've got the wrong day here. Whoop, down with the Christmas tree. Most people didn't. They just didn't. And a lot of them, from the very beginning, ensured ultimate failure. They just never proved. They proved some things, and some of them held fast to some things, and they didn't fall away completely 20 years ago, when so many did. So you come on down. Afterwards, let's pick it up in verse 13. Watch, therefore, for you know neither the day nor the hour wherein the Son of Man comes. That cannot be instruction to the first century disciples listening. Whether they knew it or not isn't even relevant. It has to be to those at the end of the age. And you continue all the way through chapter 25. Next comes the parable of the talents in 14. And then verse 21 says, well done, you good and faithful servant, the one who explored his talents. You've been faithful over a few things. I'll make you ruler over many things. It's repeated in verse 23. Well done to the one that had grown his talents too, I believe. The first one was 5. You've been faithful over a few things. Verse 23, I will make you ruler over many things. Enter into the joy of the Lord. And then others in verse 30, the unprofitable servant is cast into outer darkness. Then comes the parable of the sheep and goats, and that ends the chapter. And that's the end of the Olivet prophecy in the book of Matthew. Mark, on the other hand, says very little, but let's go over and look at it. Now, just as it opens with the description of verse 5, Mark 13. Mark 13, verse 5, answering the exact same question. Remember we read, take heed lest any man deceive you. And all right, then comes a relatively short description to verse 14, mentions the abomination of desolation. Then it talks about the same things, the fifth, sixth, and seventh seals, great tribulation, heavenly signs, day of the Lord, year of God's wrath. And then you come down to verse 33. Christ adds a little bit about what his servants had better be doing. And verse 10, the gospel must first be published among all nations. It mentions the work of God going into all the world. We're the largest religious publishing operation today the world has ever seen of any kind. Never mind among God's people through the centuries. All right, so you come down to verse 32. Now here comes the warning. Matthew had all of the rest of chapter 24 and all of 25. Here's all that Mark says. But of that day and that hour knows no man, no, not the angels which are in heaven, neither the Son, but the Father. Take you heed, watch, and pray, for you know not when the time is. But we know from Matthew, you can know in the spring that summer is near. Not that you're ignorant of everything. You can't know anything. You just can't know the exact time. If everybody knew the exact time, you see the wisdom of God in that, they would all kind of live their lives the way they wanted to, and a year before Christ, the work would be over, they'd all buckle down. They'd all circle that date on their calendar. That's what would happen, assuming that they'd even do it a year out. They might do it a month out. That's human nature. Never underestimate the power of people to forget even the most supremely important things. And that is that we are to become like Jesus Christ and to do his work. How do you forget that? But I watched almost 150,000 people do it. For the Son of Man is as a man taking a far journey, who left his house and gave authority to his servants and to every man his work. Now that's interesting. Mark puts it that way. And commanded the porter to watch. What was the goal in Matthew 24? The end, the telos, the aim was to, this gospel of the kingdom will be preached in all the world for a witness unto all nations, and then shall the end, the aim, the goal, the point shot at, so to speak, comes. And every man his work. Now, it also means the work of growing and overcoming in your own life. Overcoming is hard work. There are two ways of life. You have two choices. Every human being who is called by God has a choice. One choice is hard and the other is harder. So you have two choices. Neither one is easy. The Christian is very hard. Narrow and straight and difficult. And hard is the way that leads to life. But the alternative, the way of transgressors is hard. For the moment, I'll change that verse. The way of transgressors is harder. It's much harder to disobey God and break laws. And those laws then turn and break you. It's much harder. So you got a choice. Hard and harder. Everybody has work to do. And all of us collectively have work to do and commanded the porter to watch. So there's watch again. Verse 35, here it is a third time. Watch you therefore, for you know not when the master of the house comes, at even, or at midnight, or at the cock crowing, or in the morning. He cited four different examples, even within a given day, to make it clear. Lest coming suddenly, okay, there's key words there, he find you sleeping. That's all it says there in regard to the, 14 or 15 verses over 13 verses, I guess, over in Matthew 25, where it talks about how all the virgins slept. Well, here it gets a very short, single verse. And what I say unto you, I say unto all, watch. So you count the word watch four more times there and several times in Matthew. And now what are you up to, seven or eight or nine or something like that? And then over in Luke. That's all it says. That's all that Mark adds to the personal responsibility. But it's very important. Authority are given to his servants at the end. There's authority in God's church. There is government. A work so mighty and worldwide could never exist without not only Christ's authority, but his power. And every man does his work within the work and in his own life. And we all watch. All right, so that's Mark. Now here's Luke. Luke says this. Now, Luke is a little different, adds something very interesting. After he talked about false Christianity, war, famine, disease, earthquakes, or here, great earthquakes, verse 11, Luke 21, 11, we're in Luke 21, you come down to a description, a reference. I don't know if I said it last week. It was in my notes, and I didn't get as far as I hoped to last week, so I'll say it again if I did. I don't remember where I stopped. Verse 16, and you shall be betrayed, both by parents and brethren and kinsfolk and friends. The people who know you most who know us most are going to identify us at the very end as the rabble-rousers, the doomsayers, you know, the sundowners, the bad-mouthers. We're going to be accused in a big way by people. I can't believe my brother, my father, my mother, my child, my husband, wife. And some of you they shall cause to be put to death. Now that's one group. Some of you, that's the seventh era. And you shall be hated of all men for my name's sake. Now verse 18, a signal to those who understand and believe church eras. And there shall not an hair of your head perish. That's the other group. Now you've got verse 16, it says some die. Verse 18 says you won't lose a hair on your head. As I've tried to explain in other occasions, this is not a prophecy that you'll die with your hair perfectly combed. Okay? It's two different groups of people. One group are those who do not remain fervent. Their heart is not in the work. There they eat, drink, and be merry for tomorrow we die bunch. All right. In your patience, next verse, possess you your lives. And then it talks about the exact same things. The fifth, sixth, and seventh seals, great tribulation, heavenly signs, and the day of the Lord. And of course, in each of those accounts, then Christ talks about his own coming. You see in verse 25, signs in the sun, the moon, the stars. Well, that's the heavenly signs, sixth seal of Revelation 6. And you come to verse 32, verily I say unto you, this generation shall not pass away till all be fulfilled. Heaven and earth shall pass away, but my word shall not pass away. Okay, pretty plain. Now here comes the instruction. Not very long, not much longer than Mark, but very pointed. And take heed to yourselves. Now, this is talking about God's people and the final generation. Okay, there's no way to miss that. It's us. Lest at any time your hearts be overcharged with surfeiting and drunkenness. It's party time. Tens of millions of people will get drunk tonight. And they'll be hung over in the morning and maybe have recovered by Monday morning, and you hope not to buy a car they made on, a Monday lemon. The worst cars are made on Friday and Monday. Friday they're thinking about getting drunk, and on Monday they're recovering. And if you know the truth of that, it's a warning to you. Look at it. To us. And cares of this life. And that's going to be big before the sermon is over today, more in the second part. And cares of this life. We live in the wealthiest nation and the most affluent age by far the world has ever seen. The disciples under Roman occupation couldn't have comprehended what only those alive in the 21st century would recognize. Unlike any other age, they're sucked into malls and get the latest techno gadgets and have the latest high-definition television, and one car is not enough. You need two or three if you're a family, when for 5,900 years, nobody had any idea what a car was. Everybody wants the latest clothes and the latest exotic things from around the world. And so that day come upon you unawares. Now, such a person would not be watching, would he? Remember the warning, unawares. For as a snare, it's one of the most powerful verses in the entire Bible right now. Here it is. 15, 20 words. For as a snare, remember the warning in Matthew? Suddenly, you step into a snare, you're snapped upside down. Bam, there you are hanging from a tree. Shall it come on all them that dwell on the face of the whole earth. Now take it for what it says. Nobody is going to see it coming except those who are watching, and even some of God's people will get fooled. Watch you therefore, okay, Luke says it too, and pray always, Mark said pray, that you, watch you therefore, and pray always that you may be accounted worthy to escape all these things that shall come to pass and to stand before the Son of Man. All right, there are the descriptions. You couldn't possibly, if you're the God of the universe, Jesus Christ, you couldn't possibly utter those horrific prophecies and not tell people how to escape. There's not enough time to get into all of how that is. It's covered in many other sermons. And, of course, Christ does tell us how to escape. Now, I wanted to read one more point. As you look around, if you're reading the paper today, you know things are worse. Okay, 300,000 died in the Haitian earthquake. First serious plague disease outbreak has now afflicted thousands in Haiti. And hundreds have died as of last night. Maybe it's only 200. I don't know what it is today. But thousands have been affected by cholera. Cholera, of course, is a bacteria. It's a deadly plague. And it struck in the Tarp City outside the capital, which was where the brunt of the quake was felt. And it's one of these things that it causes the body to emit water. Cholera is just a unique bacterium in that way. And so you essentially dehydrate. And you just the fluids go out of you. And I heard on, was maybe Monday or Tuesday, that there were a great number who were suddenly afflicted with diarrhea. And I thought, cholera. And sure enough, by about Thursday, they said it's cholera. And our lives went on. I think the Haitian quake was in January, 300,000 killed. Their lives didn't go on. And our lives did, not thinking about it, but all those people are still in tent cities. The world didn't respond very fast because of the economic crisis. And there'll be many, many more like that. But I wanted to kind of set up something that I added to the book. And here it is at the end of A Fourth of Men. And I cover this. You'll actually hear me cover this, I guess, would be November 26th when it's posted. To quote God in Isaiah, we must now reason together. Follow carefully the next several all-important paragraphs. It has become time for some basic math. This is in a chapter about a fourth of all people dying prior to the tribulation. For perspective, we return to the worst recorded flu pandemic of all time, the 1918 Spanish flu outbreak. Recall that about 675,000 people in the United States were killed, along with between 40 and 100 million others worldwide. To understand the effect at the time, and for some other purposes I'll explain as we read, consider some comparisons. With the 1918 United States population of 103 million people, almost exactly one-third of today's 310 million people, 675,000 equals over 2 million dying in America if this flu came today. Now, with world population at about 1.9 billion in 1918, and if we use the mid-range estimate of 70 million dying worldwide then in the flu, that'd be, remember, 40 to 100 million they estimate died, so we pick 70. The current 6.8 billion world population yields 251 million people dying today by just this one pandemic. Therefore, I'm writing to those who are reading. I know we would hopefully not be in this next category. Do not say such horrific conditions could not strike the world. The 1.9 billion people alive in 1918, were they still alive, would say you were wrong. And remember the Black Death. Now it gets much more graphic. This single plague killed from one-third to one-half, many experts say half, of the world's population. In the mid-1300s, 1347 to 1350, 3 years. Now, just in 3 years, perhaps a third up to a half of the whole world died. No one doubts this occurred because it's a fact of history. So why should they doubt when Jesus Christ said that just one-fourth will die from the horsemen? Many other causes beyond disease, never mind just one pandemic. Here is why. The Black Death is past, the stuff of history books. The horsemen are still largely future. No one wants to imagine such an awful future, even if God foretells it will come. See the contradiction here in people's thinking. Now stop and think. Oh, you couldn't ever see a fourth of mankind die. Even though Jesus Christ said it would happen, and history shows that up to half died from a single plague in 3 years across the entire world. One could wonder how it will only take a quarter, and the answer is God fulfills prophecy as he declares it. Next, remember that war is worse than ever today, as is famine, and that there are many more deadly diseases on earth now than ever in history, far more than in the 1300s or even in 1918. Now let me jump ahead, because I want you to understand the gravity of this, to be prepared for the balance of the sermon, because I'm going to come to a colossal question in a moment. Stepping back to the subhead, given a current world population of 6.8 billion, the fourth part of the earth, Revelation 6:8, is on its face 1.7 billion human beings dead. But this number is only at our present population, so it's no more than a snapshot of a world population growing ever larger. Understand, as the population grows, a quarter of a larger base number yields a larger death count. How fast is it growing? When my father was born in 1920, the population of the earth was 1.9 billion. From creation to 1920, you get to 1.9 billion. Today, we've added 5 million more. My father would be 90 if he were alive today. In the last 90 years, we've added almost 5 billion more, 4.9. So the population's exploding. So this is important to understand. I try to be as graphic as I can, just a literally in bone-splintering language if I can. Now, here we go. Let me go back and read again. Understand, as the population grows, a quarter of a larger base number yields a larger death count. And recognize that with so many already dying, world population is still rising by 77 million people annually. Therefore, in the midst of a worldwide population explosion, 1.7 billion becomes the smallest possible death toll. Read and reread this paragraph, if necessary, until it is completely clear in your mind. But there's also the difficulty, if not impossibility, of determining the exact number of people on earth today. A little side point I want to put in here. Birth and death rates are in many places estimated. The world's best statisticians cannot precisely determine either of these figures. Neither can they perfectly track causes of death, such as the number that die from war, famine, and disease. That might be included. What can be known is that scores of millions now die each year, and many, many more, hundreds of millions, are yet to perish as a result of these conditions as we approach whatever is the population in God's mind at which the fourth is calculated. Now think of this. Still reading. If just those who have already died in the last 10 years, for instance, were added back on top of the 6.8 billion to get a correct larger base number, get closer to the number in God's mind, Earth's total population would be many hundreds of millions bigger, or perhaps a billion or more bigger than it is. What if the true base number were just 8 billion? Now remember, in the 20th century, 250 million people, just under, that's a conservative estimate, 250 million people died from 1900 to 1999 from war alone. So that would be part of the number we would have to go back to add to find out what would be if you just, but I started with just 10 years. If we went back to 1985, for instance, if we picked that number, 86, when Mr. Armstrong died, just trying to illustrate to make it clear. Around 2 billion people would perish, and we are speaking of the next handful of years. But recognize that even this number could be somewhat low. Grasp what you have learned. Fix it in the center of your mind. Then recognize that everything is in place for the worst wave of death to ever storm the earth to occur. Not as bad as what happens in the day of the Lord, but it's bad. The seals are open, and the horses, as though being whipped by their riders, are running faster every day. Their effects are not a switch that flips off suddenly. I might have read this last week, this part of it, taking a room to darkness, but rather are like a gradual turning down of a dimmer switch until a room, the world, is dark. All right. Now, I hope that makes clear the seriousness of all that will follow. Let's add one more statistic before we ask this great question. It's a little bit, in part, off of last week. Now, remember I mentioned 24,000 people starve to death every day. That's almost exactly a city the size of Wadsworth. But they're sprinkled across the world. If a Wadsworth died, one city starved to death every day. One city in one place. Nobody ever knew which city of 24,000 around the world was going to starve to death. Do you think it would have the world's attention? I'm trying to explain to you how these things can be happening and people will ignore it. They won't see the carnage. You've got to understand this. I'm going to give you three illustrations. But if every day the world knew a city of 24,000 would just be obliterated from famine, boom, gone, without notice. Now, famine would give you notice. Or we saw a whole lot of cities of 24,000 at various stages of famine, dying one after another. Each day, a little bigger city dying. Do you think you'd have the world's attention? Absolutely you would. But they're sprinkled around the world. So, well, we can eat, drink, and be merry. We can give and take in marriage and drink and party. And we can be choked by the cares of the world and surfeiting, as Christ talked about. We got time. I'll watch later. That's human nature. That's why the German citizenry did not take the Nazis seriously. There's only 1 million Nazis. There's 80 million Germans. Come on, get serious. And 100 million dead people later, people wish they'd taken a different view. But, as George Santayana said, those that do not learn the lesson of history are doomed to repeat it, and men never do. All right, now, 24,000. 82,000 people die of a broad range of diseases every day. Not 24,000, 82,000. 24,000 starving translates to 9 million starving per year. 82,000 starving daily, or dying of disease daily, translates to 30 million people dying of disease annually. An entire nation of Canada dies in a host of horrible ways every year. Now, if Canada disappeared over a period of a year, and each of those cities of 82,000 were dying, were slowly across Canada until Canada was just gone, and that's only the deaths in 1 year and only by disease, you think you'd have the world's attention? I mean, if just one city of 82,000 died in a host of terrible ways, how many ways are there to die of disease? And then you knew somewhere else in the world, that wouldn't all be in Canada, which makes it even worse, somewhere in the world we're going to lose a city of 82,000, and each day you know it'll be a bigger city and a bigger city. But it's here a little, there a little, death upon death, death, you know, quoting Isaiah, you don't see it. Abortion. 126,000 plus human babies are butchered every day on this Sabbath day. 126,000 people in this atrocity for the ages will die today. 46 million will die this year. Stunning. Now, I'm pretty sure nobody's missing those people. They never showed up. They got butchered in the womb by mass serial killers called abortionists. No, God is blunt, so I'm going to be blunt too. Those are the terms I use when I speak. But in effect, a future nation that never got out of the womb, innocent and defenseless, butchered, thrown away in trash cans all over the world, all day, every day, for years and years now, never even came to fruition. So every year, a nation of 46 million never made it out of the womb. I'm trying to illustrate. Remember, Revelation 6:8 talks about death. The four horses riding together are typified as death. So if you just take, ready, 9 million die of famine, 30 million disease, and 46 million die of abortion, just count that, because of war against the innocent, by one definition, I would call it war. I don't know if that's what Christ had in mind. But I can make a case based on certain verses, and I've cited some of them. You get to 85 million right there. Well, how many more are dying then by earthquakes, volcanoes, storms, floods, typhoons, hurricanes, you name it. War. You see, 100 million a year becomes pretty conservative. And at some point, you know, you have gang war. How many people have died in the last 10 years in Afghanistan and Iraq? You know, rockets coming into Israel. Think about all the different places in the world. There are guerrilla wars, South America and other places. What about the border with Mexico? It all piles up. It piles up. Al-Qaeda is everywhere. And you can see just terrorism alone, Luke talked about commotions, creates an acceleration. If 100 million people died of all the things we're talking about in one place on earth, and it was an annual event like the 4th of July, you think you'd have the world's attention? Absolutely. It's that it's happening all over, and nobody's ever done the math, and that's why I decided to put that math into the book. I'm sorry I have to do that. I wish it were somebody else's job. But those are realities. They're happening now. I'm pretty sure, to illustrate a point, and you're God's people, and we're supposed to have compassion. We're supposed to sigh and cry, as Ezekiel said, for the abominations that are done around the world. And abortion is an abomination for the ages, truly. How many of you in the last 24 hours have given any thought to the 126,000 butchered fetuses and embryos, right up to almost full term, that never came out of the womb? You don't think about it. And we're God's people. We're anti-abortion. All right, now, to set up the question I'm going to ask. There are riots across Europe. The French Senate did finally pass a law. You know, how tough is this? Now you can't retire at 60. It's got to be 62. 5 years ago, it was 67. Drought all over Africa, as is disease. I got one of the most sobering letters from one of our ministers in South Africa. I should have brought it up here and read to you. Two ministers were on a visit this week and wrote a letter back. Dr. Phil Yoon wrote a letter back. Unbelievable what he reported about the growth of this graveyard. Grew immense, one graveyard. There's drought across Africa. There's locusts threatening Australia. I mean, just a quick list. An aggressive pope is moving. Budget deficits are collapsing cities, states, and federal governments and threaten America, France, you know, not just Greece, but America, France, and Britain. Britain slashing 40% of spending. The alternative is federal, national bankruptcy. And the cities and states are worse. America's gone the other way. We don't take a position in that. And if it's fulfilling prophecy, fine. That's just the way it is. And, of course, the world is watching what's going to happen. Literally, the world, never mind, of course, the country, watching what's going to happen in 10 days. And that will have some effect on God's work. We've talked about all of that, how it goes. So then here's the question, and it's the greatest question I can think of at this stage. Regarding the acceleration of the horsemen, since they ride before the Great Tribulation, how close is the fifth seal? How close is the Great Tribulation? I'm going to read a few things here and try to shock you. Just a very few things. Now, I want you to look at just world instability. We'll start with a couple of articles. I could go for hours on the problems plaguing the world. But one way to know how far into the acceleration of the horsemen we are before they explode and hundreds of millions, not 100 million, but hundreds of millions are dying a year. And the world begins to, what's going wrong? Because at a certain point, you just can't miss the numbers. And that's when the false shepherds of Israel, you know, the nations of Israel, false Christianity, stand up and say, peace, peace, when there is no peace. Ah, famine and the sword will not devour you. Remember, I've covered all those prophecies. You'll be hearing about them, and they're in the book. All right, so as you try to look, where are we? We want to know, before the world sees something's wrong, and they go looking for religious and political leaders and generals and economists. So all tell them, now everything's fine. And the United Nations says, you know, the worst is behind us. We ought to see it long before they do. So the great question becomes, can we determine if we're watching? How many times we read the word watch? How close are we to the fifth seal? Because it has everything to do with the end that we're shooting at. What's the goal? What's the target? How long do we have? And what ought we be doing if we can determine we're very close? All right, here are just a few things. Understand that I could stop again now and go 2 hours on just the handful of things I'm going to show you that I've read just in the last couple weeks. Here we go. If you look at the American administration and you look at the American government, let's just have two articles, for instance, in the United States. Okay, it's important because it's the most powerful nation in the world. Won't be much longer, but it is now. Look at all the resignations going on. The single most powerful government today and in history is utterly, bitterly, and implacably divided. There's practically war. The riots you see in France are coming to our shores, a nation over five times as big as France. The issues here are bigger. We just haven't addressed them yet. The far left will be in the streets. It's coming soon. And we may get our first great indicator when we see what happens in 10 days, November 2nd. We don't participate, but oh boy, we had better watch. Now, if you look at the president has lost his national security advisor. He's lost his chief of staff. He's lost the three out of four members of his top economic team. And various others will be resigning. Probably the majority party, Senate majority leader, will probably lose office. The Speaker of the House will probably be a guy from this state and so forth. There's going to be a lot of changes. And you're going to see an absolutely gridlocked government. Now think about this. When the most powerful man in the world says, if the Republicans win the House, it will be hand-to-hand combat going forward. You can go back to George Washington. No president's ever uttered such a thing. So you see tremendous instability. Where's it going to go? Will it settle down for a while? Yes, it has to, for the work to be finished a little bit. It will be a lull before one awesome storm. Here's another article. Doomsday warnings of U.S. apocalypse gain ground. Economists peddling dire warnings, now this is just a couple weeks ago, that the world's number one economy is on the brink of collapse amid high rates of unemployment and a spiraling public deficit are flourishing here. In a short period of time, the Federal Reserve would have to print trillions of dollars to cover its deficit. I'm skipping down. And offer guarantees. All that new money could produce strong inflation, perhaps hyperinflation. Some 65% of Americans believe there will be a new recession. And the view that America is on a decline seems well ingrained in many people's minds, supported by 65% of people in America saying they think America is declining. It is true. Today's economic problems are structural, not cyclical, argued New York Times editorial writer David Brooks. He said the United States is losing its world dominance much in the same way the British Empire began to crumble more than a century ago. We are in the middle of yet another jobless recovery. Wages have been lagging for decades. Our labor market woes are deep and intractable. Well, I often think of it this way, think of reports like this as financial war, financial famine, and financial disease, and financial earthquakes and volcanoes are coming. I just don't have time to go into all the economy, but the problems today are staggering. I mean, look at Nevada. Three quarters of all homes in Nevada are underwater. Whew. Amazing how that is. All right. Crisis forces Europe to unite on financial reform. They're taking action. We know that the final resurrection of the Roman Empire, the Holy Roman Empire, will occur there. So they're going to be ahead of us. You know what Revelation says about the merchants of Babylon and so forth. The euro crisis scared European Union members enough that they have finally put aside national interests to push through Europe-wide financial reforms. In doing so, they are handing more power to a central authority, Brussels. Now, I'm just going to skip down through a few places. But what we've been discussing for years is a quantum leap that will fundamentally change Europe. Remember, we're asking, how long before the beast and false prophet, in effect, come together, a union of church and state that rocks the world? Subhead, relinquishing power. The politicians appear to be determined to make up for what they have neglected in the past. Suddenly there is talk of an economic union and even the necessity of an economic government in Europe. And yet, it says, there is no sign of the usual outcry against it now that it's being talked about again. At the meeting last Monday, finance ministers said again, more Europe, quote unquote, is needed. And for the first time, most of those present apparently meant it. So they established a trio of agencies to regulate European banking and stock markets and to initiate a joint financial policy that will punish nations that stray. Measures range from tightening up the stability pact and reducing excessive inequalities in Europe's economies to controlling and taxing the banking sector and monitoring national budgets. Try to imagine the United States in such bad shape that would allow other nations, Canada, Mexico, wherever nations around us, to monitor how we spend our money. This is a sea change. In Europe's capital cities, there's a feeling of belonging to a community that shares a common destiny, quote unquote. It goes on to say that those who distance themselves from this new sense of public spirit will find themselves increasingly isolated. We know that the countries in Western Europe, descended from Israel, will pull back. The new enthusiasm for European solutions arises from sheer fear. I'm still reading. We have seen the abyss and it has changed us, said one financial minister, Austria. Greece stood on the brink of bankruptcy and other countries were starting to teeter. A bankruptcy would have dragged down other countries. Spain, Italy, France would have been affected, Germany too, and possibly torn apart the monetary union. Hundreds of billions of euros had to be scraped together overnight to prevent a continental breakdown. During these hours, said this Australian finance minister, Prolley, a new European community was born. And then it just goes on and talks about how they're going to set it up. The Central European Bank in Frankfurt, Germany, how interesting, ancient Assyria, will monitor the European Union's entire financial system. Germany will monitor it. Why aren't we surprised? And they're going to watch cross-border transactions and in an emergency have the authority, this system, to completely take over responsibility for crisis management in a member nation. Repeat after me. 10 nations come together and give their authority to one man. I'm just warming up here, everybody. The exact nature of penalties remains just as contentious as many other details. But in principle, the budget controls, known in EU jargon as the European semester, are a done deal. I'm still quoting. This means an enormous shift of power from individual nation states to a central authority. Yeah, that's just one article. Now, I could take you, I don't have time, but I have two articles on different books that were released in Germany. And now Germany is reasserting its national identity. They don't want to hear about the past. They don't want to hear about the 40s. That's them, that's then, this is us, and this is now. Two fascinating articles. German identity, long dormant, reasserts itself. Isaiah 10, the Assyrians are called by God. Well, you know all the verses there. It's a whole chapter. They are a war-making nation, but in their heart, they think not so. They just don't see it. They don't see it. You know, the same people who sit and slosh beer in a Hofbrauhaus and sing songs, they're so mutable. They'll just change, boom, like flipping a switch. There's another book entitled Germany Does Away With Itself, and he's speaking out against immigration and how it's changing Germany, and we're losing our purity, something a fellow by the name of Adolf Hitler used to talk about from time to time, you know, the master race theory. All right, now here comes an article. Europe needs, here's the title, Europe needs a directly elected leader with charisma. One single powerful leader directly elected. Well, that's what you find. You're going to find that 10 kings give power to him. The consensus is that Europe needs a more passionate advocate if ordinary people are to overcome their apathy regarding the EU. And they talk about this kind of apparatchik type guy who leads it. It would be in the interest of the president of the European Commission to ignite a bit of enthusiasm for Europe among Europeans. But passion is not José Manuel Barroso's thing. And then it talks about you need a man who is a strategist, a thinker, who can bring vision and reality to Europe. One man, the article goes on and calls for. I just don't have time to read it all. Without that man, Europe will lack the glue to hold it together. One powerful man. Well, I mean, that's the way of history. We should not be surprised. Here's a new article. Came out just a few days ago. Pope opens new Vatican office in a bid to revive Christianity in secular Europe. In a decree, Benedict said the new office would promote church doctrine, use the media to get the church's message out, and mobilize missionary-type activities and activists. And it's called the Evangelization Office. It speaks to a new aggressiveness by a German pope. Here's another one. Pope to call for full communion between Anglicans and Catholics. Just came out a few days ago. The Pope will use in his final speech when he was in Britain of this historic state visit to urge for a restoration of full ecclesial union between the churches which separated nearly 500 years ago. The Archbishop of Canterbury said, "I'm made very uncomfortable by him coming into our house and calling for union." I read his own words. Rowan Williams is his name. Addressing the Catholic bishops of England, Wales, and Scotland, he will argue that his offer to disaffected Anglicans should not be viewed negatively, but as a prophetic gesture, end quote. The Pope will tell the bishops of the Anglican Church to welcome the introduction of a system called an ordinariate to allow Anglicans to convert while maintaining parts of their Protestant heritage. For the first time, I now understand how full ecumenism and a uniting of all Mama Rome's harlot daughters will come back together. They'll be allowed to keep some of their own personal identity. And as a result, here's an article, an entire Anglican congregation in Kent has decided to convert to Catholicism. It's the last few days. This is just unheard of things. I've been waiting 45 years to hear this kind of stuff. It's horrible to hear it. St. Peter's and Folkestone is the name of it. They're going to convert as a group. It is thought unlikely that they would be allowed to take their church with them, their buildings. At a conference of Forward in Faith, a group representing traditionalist Catholic Anglicans, its chairman, the Bishop of Fulham, John Broadhurst, announced his intention to convert to Catholicism. Various bishops have been converting. One is already a cardinal in the Catholic Church who was once an Anglican, or what we would say Episcopalian bishop. Stunning article, simply a stunning article. And more and more churches have been that way since Henry VIII didn't like the Pope are going to consider rolling over. The article continues. Here's another one that just came out, the 16th. I think this one appeared while I was preaching last week. Merkel says German multicultural society has utterly failed, her words. Can you imagine the President of the United States standing up? Is this the president of Germany, standing up and saying multiculturalism in America has utterly failed? Only one who thinks in the Assyrian way would dare say such a thing, uttered a week ago. And Angela Merkel knows the Pope loathes Muslim migration into Europe. It's changing the face of old Europe and our roots. I've heard his quotes. In a speech in Potsdam, she said what the so-called multicultural concept, where people live side by side happily, did not work. And mainstream politicians, up to 30% of them in Germany, came out and agreed with her. The foreign workers were not coming in and assimilating. Now, there was always going to be a final, unique generation in all history that would come. We are that generation. This generation that Christ referred to three times, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, we read the verses. For this generation, things would be so different. Even very promises of God to all other generations past and all generations to come would not apply. They would become unclaimable promises. Let me explain something, because I want to try to break a mindset. There's only one final leader in God's work at the end of the age. You know, it fell on me, so my job is to speak bluntly. Now, Isaiah 58 and verse 1, you don't have to turn there, you all know it, says, "Cry aloud, spare not, lift up your voice like a trumpet and show my people their transgressions and the house of Jacob their sins. We know who the 12 tribes of Jacob or Israel are. My people in the scriptures generally always refers to those God is working with. He's calling and converting and giving his spirit to. Now, brethren, I'm sure you understand that if the job of the leader of the church is to cry aloud to the world, for whom all the marbles and all the cards are not on the table, not everything is at stake, it's just their physical protection in years to come if they wake up, you see, or if they go into the tribulation or the day of the Lord or take the mark of the beast, all the marbles aren't on the table for them. And I'm supposed to cry aloud to them. And I'm sure you understand I am to warn those of the seventh era, with the rest of the church supporting and doing their part as well, of course, not just a one-man operation here by any means. Then how much more should I cry aloud to the church, God's people, my people, Isaiah 58:1, when certain things need to be made clear? Because I want to try to break a mindset. There is sort of this thought in America, but in other nations of the world, in the greatest time of economic plenty, I know we're in a downturn, but relatively speaking, for 6,000 years, men couldn't even comprehend the worst part of the economic downturn if they could enjoy it in ages past. They just couldn't imagine. I want us to understand, you cannot have life the way everybody else did, the way you previously have, or the way we will teach people in the millennium when Christ returns. Here's an example. Think of the fifth commandment. Honor your father and mother. Let's just turn over and read it together and see if something pretty obvious comes out to certain ones of you. Exodus 20. Exodus chapter 20. And we'll pick it up in verse 12. Honor your father and mother. Now, we typically mention the fifth commandment as honor your father and mother, but that's not the whole commandment. That your days may be long upon the land which the Lord your God gives you. Now, I'm trying to illustrate a point. I'm going to give you several examples here. You cannot claim that. You cannot claim that promise in this generation. Now, if you're already old, and you may or may not have honored your parents, then I guess you can. But for a great many, the great majority of God's people, will get nowhere near age 70. I'm a few weeks from 62. I believe the work will be over well before I'm 70 years old. We'll be into all the things we're talking about. We're into some of them now, of course. My parents made it into their 70s. My grandparents made it into their 80s and one into the 90s. I won't have that long life. They didn't, you know, in some cases my grandparents didn't know the truth. My parents did. They learned it later, of course. Ephesians and Colossians says the same thing. It's the first commandment with promise. It's a promise. But you know, young people, you honor your parents today, you are not promised long life. On the land, you'll have long, eternal life. You'll be born into the kingdom of God at age 30, you see. Here's another one. Hebrews 9 and verse 27. Hebrews 9 and verse 27. Let's go over there and read it. Very interesting statement. And you can go through the Bible and start finding your own. Here's another one. It's related to age, as many of these are, but look at this one. And as it is appointed unto men once to die, but after this, the judgment. After you die comes the judgment. Not for those who are alive and remain and who are caught up with Christ, according to Paul in 1 Corinthians and 1 Thessalonians. There is a generation, the entire church at the end of the age, who won't die. All previous people who have ever lived died. There's no exceptions. You know, the patriarchs, the preachers of righteousness, all the way back to righteous Abel, they're all dead. You know, Job said, hide me in the grave till your wrath is past. Unless you're very, very old and near the end right now, you wouldn't say what Job did. He knew what God's wrath was. He understood the day of the Lord was coming, the year of God's wrath. You understand? We're a generation in two ways now demonstrated to be an exception. Here's another one. God commanded Adam and Eve and those who marry, be fruitful and multiply. and replenish the earth. Satan had destroyed the earth. Now, and let's think about that. I remember years ago hearing for the first time, you know, young people, oh boy, I won't be old enough. I won't get to find out what sex is like. You know, you hear that. And I won't get to be married and have children. There are a lot of people who will, younger people, some of the adult youngsters, we'll put it that way, they're not kids, but they're not older adults, who will never be able to enjoy marriage. Maybe at the place of safety they do, but they won't be able to enjoy children. Ask them, would you rather be in the family of God or live on into the millennium, let's say, if you could have such a choice and you can't, and have a family and children. They'd pick be in the family of God. But I'm trying to illustrate a point. Some people will not be able to be fruitful and multiply. All right? Here's another one. Turn to Proverbs 16 and verse 31. Proverbs 16 and verse 31. The hoary head, that's the white hair, is a crown of life if it be found in the way of righteousness. It's a crown of life if it be found in the way of righteousness. All right, unless you gray early, there are few that do. The great majority will never experience that. My mother didn't get gray hair until her late 60s. I've got some now, early 60s. My dad lost his hair when he was about 30. And then it got gray. I don't ever remember it anything other than gray and bald, my dad. But my mother, I think she got her very first gray hair when she was older than I am. That's amazing. But she lived long enough that she got gray hair. She died at 70. But for many, you will never be able to wear that crown. I'm trying to illustrate a point. It's a crown. That's a crown you will never be able to wear. You say, well, that's not a big deal. I'm not saying it's a big deal. It's big enough in God's mind to tell all those who grow old in righteousness that you should think of a white head as a crown. So I think we want to be careful dismissing it, or we miss a little bit of God's understanding. It's, you know, a beautiful look to an older person, and there's an elegance and a dignity to such people. Point is, forget it. Won't happen. I just thought of a few of these very quickly. Here's another one. Stay in Proverbs 17:6. Just turn a few verses ahead. Children's children are the crown of old men. Oh, if you're not going to have children, many of you will never have grandchildren. And the glory of children are their fathers. All right, fine. The first half, you may never be able to have that kind of crown either. There's two crowns you may never be able to have. I can appreciate that in a way I didn't before I had grandchildren. I now have 7 with an 8th on the way, and one other I inherited. So 8 with a 9th on the way. And I appreciate that. When God called me, I thought the work was going to end a lot sooner and that I might not even be able to have children. Now I'm on my way to, you know, grandchild number 9. My oldest son, you know, inherited one and had 4, 5 daughters and inherited one, had 4 more of his own. So I can appreciate that for some you have it, others you don't. Proverbs 13 and verse 22. My children and grandchildren will have to understand this. And for many of God's people, you have to break a way of thinking. You have to break a way of thinking. This is the last verse we'll turn to. A good man leaves an inheritance to his children's children, his grandchildren. And the wealth of the sinner is laid up for the just. He lays up his money and the just get it. Interesting statement. But the first half's what I'm focusing on. A good man leaves an inheritance to his children's children. I will not do that. Now, when my father died, he left an inheritance to his 3 children and his 7 grandchildren on behalf also of my mother who died ahead of my father. He was in God's way. When my uncle died about 17 months ago in California, he also, not in God's way, interestingly, left an inheritance to his 2 nephews and niece, my mother's younger brother, and to his 7 grandnieces and grandnephews. He was a good man. And I didn't say necessarily a converted man. Most of the people who would have read this in the Old Testament who did it were not converted. He was a very good man. Everybody knows how I feel about my wonderful uncle. Didn't change it because he's dead. So I got an inheritance twice in my life because of good men, one converted, one not. I will never be able to do that. That doesn't apply to me. And I know a lot of God's people are setting money aside like things are going to go on. Who are you kidding? You'll never leave anything to your children. And you need to ask, well, do you want to? Never mind your children's children. That wasn't something my parents faced or my uncle who wasn't thinking this way faced. You'll never have time to build a business. I ran a successful business, but in my case, only because I inherited it when my dad died. Again, part of my inheritance. Or other things that you could think of. There's maybe seven or eight. I just tried to illustrate a point. I'm trying again, as we close here, to break a mold in your thinking. Now, turn it over. If there are things we never do, only one generation does the final work. Nobody else has to break the mold of their thinking out there in the world to do that. They're out pursuing whatever they're pursuing, the cares of the world. Only one generation lives through and is protected, largely because they did the work and did so during the ride of the four horsemen, when in their patience they possess their lives. You might think about that. We're unique. The old molds don't fit for one generation, looking forward and backward. One group of God's people, one generation of God's people, are simply unable to claim certain promises, and they have on them an historic burden no one else has to bear. We all understand the verse, take up your cross and follow Christ. It means your burden. It was a Greek idiom. We have a certain burden. I hope we've considered a privilege, an honor, not just an obligation or duty or responsibility. And we have the burden of the work to announce the greatest government the universe has ever seen is coming to all nations of planet Earth, and we're going to be part of it to a big degree, how much we participate in the final announcement of it in all nations. We're going into all nations and territories now. And that the nations that descended from Israel, you know, the world's confusing, is just the Jews. Well, that's the 12th. That all of them have to be warned. And we get this also just unique. Now this is something is singular, it's unique, and if it's unique, it's singular. But I'm just for emphasis, singularly unique promise to be protected. I mean, think of Ecclesiastes 9 and verse 10. What your hand finds to do, do it with your might. For there's no work, nor device, nor knowledge, nor wisdom in the grave where you're going, except we're not going into the grave. We don't get a full lifetime. If people are told who get a full lifetime to what your hand finds to do, Solomon wrote, do it with your might. Because once you're dead, there's not a thing you can do. There's no work, device, knowledge, or wisdom in the grave where you're going, but you're not going there. How much more ought you act every day as though you're fulfilling Ecclesiastes 9:10, for instance, in doing God's work, and God has given, remember in Mark, to every man his work in your own life, growing and overcoming and changing and developing the character of God so you can be given membership in his family. Just according to Ecclesiastes 9:10. Most people don't do that when they have a lifetime, which at the end of that life, they're going to say, wow, that was short. I wish I'd have worked harder and done more things. How much more when we won't have a full lifetime and we have the most important commission on the face of the earth in history ever, ought we fulfill Ecclesiastes 9:10? Now, I'm going to read one brief quote and we will break. And we'll come back and we will discuss entirely different things coming off of all of what we've covered for what will then be two long sermons. Here are a couple other things I added to the book. I wanted them in two chapters. One was in the chapter entitled Those Who Escape, because I want the world to know the reason that this awesome work and all of this literature, free of charge, broadcast, everything that we do is free, is because there is a people quietly toiling in the background, doing the heavy lifting, bearing the burden, the heat of the day. I want them to understand. They may want to come on along and help. All right. The final era of Christ's church, Laodicea, lacks sufficient zeal to receive God's blessings. Near the end of the chapter, those who escape. And promise of protection. We have seen that Jesus describes those of this era as lukewarm early in the book, stating that because they are neither cold nor hot, I, Christ, will spew you out of my mouth. Verse 17 continues with Jesus describing a smugness that has taken hold of even many of his people. In the world at large, most people do not get excited about much of anything, preferring to relax, be cool, take it easy, not get worked up. Hang out, you know, you hear all these terms change through the, but they're all about the same, little different, about the same. But this is not a picture of the true Christian. He is one who is on fire for all things of God. His whole heart, mind, and being is committed to living God's way. He continually seeks to fully submit to God, yielding to God's direction in all matters. He recognizes and practices this instruction: I beseech you, brethren, by the mercies of God, that you present your body as a living sacrifice, holy, acceptable unto God, which is your reasonable service. Christians in the world don't think it's reasonable to hand their entire life to God. I mean, really do it? Oh, I gave my heart to the Lord. They might give him their heart in some symbolic nonsense gesture. It has no meaning whatsoever. But to actually do it seems very unreasonable. And yet, to the true Christian, it's a reasonable service. You know, we're told we're bought with a price. Most people think of sacrifices as dead. Well, the Christian is a living sacrifice, Paul wrote to the Romans. Most in the world do not want to sacrifice for any but themselves, feeling this to be very unreasonable. They are committed to getting while the getting is good, unconsciously seeming to follow the unstated goal of seeing who can die with the most toys. The vast majority of people lead their lives reflecting little more than seeing how much they can accumulate in this life. And dynamite cannot separate them from possessions or money. But the Christian recognizes that his life belongs entirely to God. He is then committed to using it entirely for God's purpose. He is interested in serving others and giving rather than getting. His heart is in preaching, giving the gospel to the world, and God's warning message in Ezekiel to the modern nations descended from ancient Israel. He wants to help fulfill Christ's command incumbent on his servants for 2,000 years. Go you therefore and teach all nations, baptizing them into the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, teaching them to observe all things whatsoever I've commanded you. In a covetous, pleasure-driven world, few any longer understand sacrificing and going without wants they previously thought were needs. As the 1930s generation came to understand by suffering through over 10 years of the Great Depression before going straight into World War II. In a sense, it could be said that those who escape, remember that's the title here, all that will come will have paid a certain price, in quotes, so that this could happen. There is no free lunch for anyone. These will have given of themselves beyond all measure. They will have truly comprehended Jesus' words, for whosoever shall save his life shall lose it, and whosoever shall lose his life for my sake shall find it. The Church of God is truly an exception in the modern world. Each member understands that bearing an historic, much is given, much is required burden is individually required, and according, that's from Luke 12:48, and according to ability to complete the work set before the church. But all willingly and cheerfully shoulder the burden. I'm telling people about this unique people in the background. You know, mine's the face that everybody sees, but all the other faces are just as important, not as visible. But all willingly and cheerfully shoulder the burden of this necessary duty involving time, prayers, service, and financial sacrifice so others can learn, be given what they were privileged to receive. And now this. Delivering Christ's real message, and this is in the chapter called Awesome Announcement. Delivering Christ's real gospel to the world, the good news of the coming kingdom of God, is and always has been the true work of God's church. I want to come back a second time, deeper in the book, and say a little more. While the commission began with the original apostles, the restored church of God continues it today. The message and goal are the same, only the methods differ. When Jesus stated, I will build my church, it went far beyond beginning, increasing, and protecting that church, beyond just ensuring its survival. There is a great transcendent purpose for the church that Jesus built, the only true church of God. Preaching the gospel of a coming world-ruling super-government over all nations is the mission of God's church, and every member in it is called to become part of this exciting work. Those assisting realize the need to spread the truth of God's real message, to announce a new world order coming to a struggling, suffering civilization, incapable of even addressing, let alone fixing, its mounting troubles and difficulties. This commission is twofold. First is to go into all the world and preach the gospel to every creature. Second is to feed the flock of God, to supply each member of God's church with strong spiritual food. Verses cited. As God's members are fed, they grow spiritually, allowing them to serve and dedicate themselves more to the church's great first commission. Today, large numbers of people can learn God's full truth as never before. Many thousands around the world are learning sound, proven principles straight from their Bibles, helping them to live happier lives and become better citizens. The restored Church of God is a fountain of true knowledge in a parched world with ever-increasing evils. We offer more literature, more truth in writing, and number of pages and publications than at any time in the history of God working with mankind. You may wish to carefully check this for yourself, and then I cite some websites. Also, our three websites collectively are now the largest and most extensive religious websites of any kind in the world. God's people are on a crusade to take Christ's announcement of the kingdom of God, the most important message in existence, to a sick, dying world. They are passionate about, consumed with, and know that they need to complete Christ's great commission while there is still time. John 9:4. You are now reading God's final announcement and warning offered to all who will take heed. It has been average people toiling quietly in the background who believe and live Jesus' words, it is more blessed to give than receive. So I repeat it. And that have made possible the fulfillment of Matthew 24:14 and 28:19 and 20. It is their unselfishness and sacrifice that have allowed for the many offers of free books and booklets, not cheap tracts that are easy to produce and distribute, referenced throughout this volume. There are scores more that have not been mentioned. Dependent on God to empower them, they have almost completed this historic heavy lifting, this bearing the heat of the day while others pursued pleasure, of warning great nations and announcing the coming kingdom of God. There is still time to lessen their burden, to give help.